Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hey everyone, this is Daniel Paris, a host of the New Books Network. I'm delighted today to have as my guest Andrew Monaghan, author of Dealing with the Russians, a new book that just came out from Polity Press. Andrew is at the Royal United Services Institute in London and one of England's leading Russian specialists and the author of several other books on Russia. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me.
Daniel, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as a historian of the Soviet Union myself and someone who keeps track of what's going on in our current relations, I was really quite struck by the premise of your book that lays out quite in a straightforward fashion that we're still it's sort of like the adage about the generals who fight the last war, that after, call it a half century of conflict between the Soviet Union and the Western powers, that conflict sort of went away when the Soviet Union went away for a decade or so, depending on how you view it. But after Crimea, the Russian return to Crimea, Cold War appears to be back. And that seems to be both the problem and the opportunity from the way you present it. That is, the West is still approaching this relationship using old tools, old tool sets, old institutions, old guide frameworks, and that you're really calling for a new approach that is more up to date. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
I think that's a very accurate way of putting it. I entirely agree that the tool set that we use, the mental tool set that we use is out of date, actually. And it's been used so often that it's become second nature. It's become very, how could I put it, close to comfortable mental furniture. We sort of slip into these arbitrary comparisons with some stage during the Cold War or these very emotional analogies. And I think it doesn't help us to understand the nature of the current situation or the challenges that Russia poses to the Euro-Atlantic community, to the UK, to the US. So the book is arguing for to move on effectively from the 20th century and to look at Russia as a 21st century challenge. That's what I'm trying to get at in the text.
And what is interesting, and this book will be of significant interest to policy people, is that there's a lot of nuts and bolts institutions, offices of the NATO, offices of the UK, of the United States, and it's you know, for people who from our side of the pond, from Washington D.C., policy people really benefit from this account. But from my perspective as a historian, it also comes down to language, even the very terms that we're using. And you make a big deal about this, which I think is good. You know, deterrence and Cold War, all of these terms themselves, which people might use casually, actually have loaded meanings. And it's time even not just to say, hey, this office or this particular policy, but even the terminology that we use, you have to think about it before applying it for applying 20th century terminology to a 21st century relationship.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more as someone who was educated as a historian originally myself. I come back to the use of history in the book. And one of the things I hope that comes through is that history isn't particularly about just drawing analogies. It's actually about how to think through and how to use empathy and so on to understand how others may see the world. That doesn't mean we necessarily agree with them, of course, but right at the heart of this is terminology and how we go about understanding the nature of the questions that are being posed of us. So you've mentioned Cold War, but there's also a number of others that we talk about with regards to Russia, the sort of abstraction of the challenge, hybrid warfare, for instance, or measures short of war, which don't really describe the nature of the problem very satisfactorily. I mean, I do hope that the book is, while it is aimed in some senses at policymakers, the idea in my mind when I was writing this was to provide a text that the interested individual could read. So it's certainly for policymakers, but I wanted to start right at the beginning and draw people into it as wide an audience as possible. I think if our leaders are going to talk about great power competition for the 21st century, I think it's something that the voting public ought to be thinking about also. So it's intended to be nice and broad in that sense, while also trying to guide towards a bit of policy and thinking.
I think it's a very optimistic. You speak very highly of the voting public. you set a fairly high bar for the voting public. I'm encouraged by your optimism. I would say that yes, those people in the kind of the reading public who see through the fact that a policy and institutions need to really understand what is underneath them. That broader sense of politics of the public. It may not be every single last voter, but a good number of them would want to understand. And frankly, the same issue could arise with the relationship of the West to China, to areas in the Middle East. We have a set of, broadly speaking, post-World War II institutions and set up in post-World War II. They're literally buildings in Washington, D.C. and buildings in London with staffs and budgets and so forth. Are they right for the times? And that's a question of very popular or broad interest. And your answer is, at least in regard to the Russians, showing their age, I would say, would be a delicate way of putting it. And that you think kind of nudge them. Let's go over some of not just the notion of Cold War, but you mentioned some of the doctrines. You know, we have removed the tanks and we're not worried about the fold the gap anymore. But the basic concept, even if the places have remained of that type of approach, remains in regard to whether it's NATO planning or the United States or the UK. And it just seems very out of date, is your point. And can you give some other examples of that might grab readers and say, yeah, boy, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We're still playing from a 60-year-old playbook.
Sure. I just wanted to agree with your point earlier about it being about the nature of how this reaches the broader audience. And you mentioned China and so on. It's noticeable that people are using the same language with regards to China currently. We've got a whole new discussion of new Cold War with China. It's very noticeable also. One of the things I do address in the book is how we pick up concepts that we've used from one part of the world and we impose them on another part. A completely different part, incidentally, which demonstrates also a very different set of characteristics. So it's how China thinks about going to war. People have talked about, or how China defends itself, for instance, is terms have been developed for that were then imposed on Russia recently. And we now have this sort of, so a generic lexicon to talk about all sorts of wide-ranging and different challenges. But when it comes back to it, and thinking about the new Cold War, why should we be wary of these points? Well, I was thinking about how best to describe this, and it's a dangerous line, of course, because it's a bit of an analogy. But I was reading a book recently about the memoirs of a senior Allied general in the Second World War. And when he was going back to war in the Second War, he found himself stopping off and being billeted in the early part of the war in the same places that he'd been billeted in the First World War. I thought this was very interesting because it demonstrates to us how things can change dramatically, because, of course, the Second World War was fundamentally different to the First. in how it evolved, how it wound through, and so on, and of course how it ended. So this is the first part of how we think about history. The second part is that our societies are fundamentally different now. If you think back to the 1980s and so on, you have a mobilized society that pays much more in defense in many ways, particularly across Europe, than they do now. In fact, we have demilitarized societies in many ways. So our societies have changed so fundamentally that these old comparisons are no longer relevant. And then finally, the geography, of course. It's Europe looks so different to how it did during the Cold War era.
The notion that the Baltic republics would be part of NATO and that NATO would be right up against the underbelly of modern Russia is, from 30 years ago, 40 years ago, utterly inconceivable.
Yes. And I mean, the idea that, you know, for instance, we'd be talking, as we have been for a bit over 10 or 12 years now, that Ukraine and Georgia could become members of NATO. I mean, that demonstrates to us how the geography of Europe has shifted. And what we're talking about is Poland, Czechia, Hungary, and so on, all being member states of NATO. Romania, Bulgaria, I mean, the list goes on. NATO has more than doubled in size. This changes the infrastructure and the geography of Europe fundamentally. The most obvious example about why this makes it different, of course, is that Kaliningrad, the Russian exclave, in some senses is surrounded by NATO member states. Or, from the other way around, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia are right there, surrounded by Russia. So that's why the nature of history, it's so important to understand history as continuity and change.
If you see what I mean. I don't want to get too far off of your book into other interests, but the French Anglo defense of Poland was not feasible in 1939, and the a NATO defense of the Baltics, is it feasible in 2020? I don't know.
This is part, again, this is why I think actually your comment is absolutely relevant to the book, because the book tries to talk about what things like deterrence and defense and dialogue might mean. So your question comes right to how could we defend our allies in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, even. And that's part
easily.
Of nature. Not easily is exactly the question. So, what do we mean by deterrence? Mm-hmm. What do we, you know, are we using deterrence as a synonym for defense, or are we using it as a synonym for reassurance? And therefore, also, it's how we are about understanding the other in this. And of course, this is Russian thinking, because although people have talked about exercising it and thought about it for already 6 or 7 years or more. Personally, I don't think that the Russian military particularly seeks to invade and occupy the Baltic states. That's my own personal view. Many have sought to run temporary exercises to test that and have said that the Baltic states would be very difficult to defend. Yes. I personally, that's that odd thing about deterrence, which I try to explore in the book, is that you have to be in the thinking of your adversary to know what it is you're trying to deter.
And here is a good example of an old paradigm misapplied to a modern situation. Economic warfare or economic engagement or information engagement play a much greater role. You don't need a main battle tank for those things. As a matter of fact, a main battle tank gets in the way of economic engagement or information engagement. It may be sufficient to pull those levers. That is, policy can be defined in terms, and goals can be defined in those levers rather than in terms of physical occupation of territory.
I think that's a very fair point. I would maybe add a couple of, I suppose, footnotes to that. Is that, first of all, that the Russians tend to view things in a rather different way. So economic measures like sanctions, for instance, we would consider to be measures short of war as a sort of an attempt at deterrence and so on. Whereas I think for many Russian defense thinkers and security thinkers, economic sanctions are statecraft as part of warfare. So there's a slight gap there in understanding. The second is of course, while we do tend to talk about Russian measures short of war, interference in elections and so on, and understandably so, what we don't tend to talk about is the rebuilding of Russian combat capability that's very visible in Syria and very explicitly made in Syria. But also the combat that's taken place in Ukraine. So we end up talking about these, you know, hybrid measures, for instance, and we focus a lot on election and domestic political interference. Understandable. But we cannot at the same time overlook the ramifications of and the consequences for the use of military force as a tool of policy.
Remind me the name of the gap. It begins with an S that has replaced the Fulda gap. It's in your book, but I recall
well,
that.
Well, it's the Suwalki gap is what people call it.
Yes, that's it. Yes.
And I must admit, I'm not a. Some of my friends and colleagues are focusing on this. I don't think that this is a particular point of focus for Russia. I can understand its regional and local importance. Of course, I can. But I think that if there is a dash made through the Suwalki gap, we have a very serious wider problem. So it's an indication of something broader.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, you know, the sort of the first part of the book, and to some extent, you know, the premise is summarized by the old adage that the generals are fighting the last war, the privates end up sacrificing in the current war. So the generals are, you know, there's a lot of this old infrastructure, and you think it serves the West ill. It also, to some extent, interestingly, it serves Russia ill as well, because it creates lack of communication. The two sides are talking past one another. What's the more positive agenda? You know, where let's shift to what you suggest would be more appropriate in both our understanding of Russia intentions and making sure the Russians don't misunderstand us. Again, we don't think a lot. We don't think of economic sanctions as an act of war. But if the Russians do, we need to be aware that they're going to interpret it that way. I may have exaggerated a bit. But so what is the positive agenda and that would get, you know, readers will want to say, okay, this is a good go forward plan that's outlined in your book.
First of all, this is one of the difficulties of writing about Russia at the moment is the how can I put it this, the shaping of a positive agenda, because most of the difficulties are actually based on policy disagreements and long-standing policy disagreements. So, I mean, almost across the board, London and Moscow disagree. I mean, yes, there are some places for conversation, nuclear questions, and so on. But on almost everything, European security architecture in Ukraine, you could talk about what happened in Iraq and Syria. You could talk about a variety of questions, many of which you'd find London or Washington on one side and Moscow on the other. Same for Brussels and Moscow. So there's a very large pile of what I call policy rubble over which we will have to cross to begin to create dialogue with the Russians. And I think really that what we're going to have to do is think of dialogue in the longer term. There won't be some grand bargain, in my view, as I try to argue in the book. No grand bargain over European security and so on, because the two sides are fundamentally opposed. Where I think it is important to be reaching out is to actually have what I think of as non-strategic points of contact. And that is slightly lower level than the senior politicians. Practical questions, technocratic questions, bureaucratic questions. And I think here there are some aspects where we can find some overlap. For instance, I point a bit in the book at things that, you know, when if we look to the future, there are problems that are emergent problems. They're new 21st century problems in some senses. And we're looking at things like the impact of climate change, the impact of demography. These are things that I think are places where we could start to have some form of practical technical exchanges. By that I mean that the European population in many ways is in a similar situation to the Russian one. It becomes elderly. Mm-hmm. There's also a drive towards urbanization. So there are similar technical problems. It's much the same with climate change. Now, London and Moscow may disagree on the politics of climate change, but one of the things they see, they certainly face in reality, is the practicality of climate change. And Moscow sees this as much as anybody else does. Yearly, they have big floods and fires. And in fact, we're seeing this at the moment while people talk about novel coronavirus and the oil price war. It's also notable that Mr. Putin is meeting online, of course, meeting local regional authorities to cope with fires and flooding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are areas which are not on the same agenda where we can actually start to rebuild some form of contact. Because as I say, I think it's going to be difficult to find any sense of substantive cooperation over the old agenda. And there's no reason why the old agenda should not continue to be debated. We do have these.
The institutions, I'm more familiar with on the U.S. side, but the institutions, some of them are still around from 20 or 30 years ago, the funding institutions that tried to support these dialogues. The institutions that sent me to the Soviet Union 30 years ago, to the best of my knowledge, they don't exist anymore because they just faded away when the Cold War faded away. And or if they do, they're a shell of themselves. So, you know, how do we start a new, and again, I could use the phrase very lightly, which would be incredibly insensitive to the Russians, a new Marshall Plan for fixing this problem. But again, whereas in the West, the Marshall Plan would have been viewed as a positive, from the Russian perspective, the Marshall Plan was a way of encircling Russia in a hostile way. So even there, the terminology is the terminology from the past haunts any effort to responsibly manage a current relationship. So I don't even know what words to use, but you know, what are some of the institutions I should tell what readers, and I think it's actually quite, you do have a bit of a UK bias. You are obviously based there, and it is it does reference NATO and US policy institutions and mechanics and statements, but there's it is a very interesting perspective. Now, here's where you will get a little bit offended. Please don't. But you acknowledge yourself that the Russians have no longer consider the UK a serious foe, so they spend less time on you, and you admit that out front. I didn't want to rub salt into your wounds, but it does, I think, give you and the American reader in particular a view from the sidelines. Please don't be offended. A view from the sidelines, which is actually very useful in highlighting how outdated some of the U.S. institutions or U.S. thinking might be, and to some extent also the Russians, because you guys are on the sideline to some extent now.
I think there's a lot to that. Not offended in the slightest, as you know. I wrote most of it, and when you have to come down to writing it, you absorb it. I mean, I would frame it slightly differently though in terms of what the book tries to do, because yes, of course, I'm writing a little bit for a London audience, but it's really for a Euro-Atlantic audience. And in many ways, the British experience, London's experience with Moscow, has been a very interesting lens through which to view the wider Euro-Atlantic relationship with Russia. And that, so in many ways, the British experience is not terribly different to that of Brussels or Washington. Slightly more vivid terms sometimes. That's true. Mm-hmm. But also, it's a reminder to other states that London also should, in my view, be playing more of a role in this. And in many ways, I think that London has actively stood back over a number of years, possibly over the last decade. And that's why Moscow doesn't view it as being a terribly important interlocutor, not only because they've had serious disagreements, but because London hasn't always taken a very prominent role in the relationship. And I was trying to encourage the British authorities to do that a little more. I also think that the structures of how we go about rebuilding our way of dealing with the Russians, it's very similar in London to in Washington in some senses. There's an effort needed to rebuild the links between state policymaking on the one hand and non-state Russia expertise. I think this has evolved quite a lot over the last decade or so, but there is a need to reunify that knowledge better than has been the case in the last 5 or 6 years.
I keep waiting for the phone to ring and calling me yeah. back, but I just stare at the phone and it's awfully quiet.
I think you're right. Go on.
Many of the people who left Russian studies and Soviet studies when the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, the reason I'm on this podcast, as it were, is remain a very, very keen interest. And here's a good, during the Cold War, there weren't too many business people who were involved in engaging the Soviet Union for obvious reasons, because there wasn't much there. But there is actually now a large coterie of people, I think, like myself, who have a keen interest on the relationship between Russia and the West and defining that. But we're no longer part of government. We're no longer part of the official Soviet studies or Russian studies apparatus. And I do sometimes wonder when I see policy statements coming out from governments that saying, where did you speak to your Russia hands before you made that statement? And I suspect the answer is they didn't, because those Russian hands didn't exist, because there aren't as many of them in the government as there used to be on the U.S. side. And that even I can observe, and it is dismaying to me.
I think it's true. I do think things are evolving a little bit. There is more effort now being made both in Washington and in London to bring more people into the discussion, to have more government servants who are thinking about Russia explicitly. So I think that's beginning to evolve. But I do think there's a disconnect between some of the aspects of non-government expertise and how that might feature into policymaking. That's one of the points that has been evolving and developing since 2013, when in many ways there were very few indeed in government looking at Russia. That has changed. Yes.
Let's turn to that, which is Crimea. That's really the turning point in your book, which the light is flipped on, and you can see with Crimea, you see that the light's on, and we don't have an effective means to deal with this new, and we'll call it, whether you call it rising or returning entity. And I take it that was sort of almost the reason that you ended up writing this particular book, was the absence of clear policy institutions, framework, and methods of engagement after Crimea. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's a fair summary. Yes, for me, the interesting point about, I mean, there's much to say about Crimea. The first point would be, though, to say that Crimea puts us into puts the Euro-Atlantic community and Russia almost into different time zones. Because what I mean by that is that the Euro-Atlantic community tends to look at Russia, I mean, this is in Washington and in London and often in NATO also, as having been reawoken to Russia in 2014.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then people track back a bit and they say, well, this happened in Georgia in 2008. Then maybe there were the energy disputes in 2006, 2009. And we mustn't forget the poisoning of Litvinenko, and we mustn't do this, and we mustn't forget that. But really what we're doing is starting from 2014, tracking back to find the origins of our dispute with Russia. On the one hand, that's one time zone. On the Russian time zone is a very different one, and it goes right back to the early 1990s. And you find there the rollout of a series of persistent Russian arguments that, whether one agrees with them or not, the persistent arguments that NATO should A, no longer exist, B, shouldn't have enlarged, and C should now be considering winding itself up because it's more of a challenge to the current environment than a benefit. And so you actually have a very different trajectory in Moscow that you could say starts with NATO's Kosovo campaign in 1999, that then rolls through the war in Afghanistan 2001 onwards, but particularly picks up speed from 2002-2003 with the invasion of Iraq and the US withdrawal from the the anti-ballistic missile treaty. So you have two very different time zones taking shape there. And this means that in many ways, Moscow and the Euro-Atlantic community live on different planets, not to say different galaxies, which makes dialogue so difficult and deterrence really difficult, because I'm not sure we really understand each other. And where we do understand each other, we disagree fundamentally.
And I wonder if, again, as a historian, I find that the calmest period of relations, and again, this can be a historical simplification, but I wonder if isn't helpful. And I make this argument in print. I've made this argument in print as well recently, is that a more of a 19th century game of chess, which ends frequently in draws, is a healthier environment. That is the great powers, balance of powers in Europe. The 19th century paradigm is healthier than the 20th century and the way the 21st century is shaping up, which is ideologically driven. And in an ideological conflict, there are no draws. There are only winners and losers. And that's kind of a controversial statement. I'm making it, not necessarily you. And so you can dispute it or not accept it or ignore it. But that to me seems to be a more stable framework for, as you put it, entities that fundamentally disagree on principled issues. That a better approach there than provoking is maybe, you know, forms of stalemate or draw chess draws. So see that same issue, because I too don't see the resolution to these underlying conflicts. And for me, the underlying conflict is Russia and the West, the relationship between Russia and the West. This is a tension that's lasted for three centuries, coming up on four centuries, as to, you know, are we all moving in the same direction or are we not? And if we are moving in the same direction, boy, it's with fits and starts and awfully slow. If we're not, then a stalemate or a draw type framework is a lot less dangerous than a ideological cage fight battle to the death. And that's, you know, maybe that's not what your book is about, but I'm just highlighting that as a way of interpreting these mechanisms of managing a conflict, which your book is about, that if we can get to a draw, that's not a bad outcome.
I mean, I think this is, your point about ideology is a very interesting one, because the first set of arguments about whether we're in a new Cold War or not, which came about in the early to mid 2000s, just to give you an idea of how often this is echoed. The first time this came up, people refuted it by saying there is no ideological element to it. So it's not like the Cold War. And I think this is a very interesting, because it helps us to understand change and continuity. Because, I mean, when I first started arguing against this several years ago now, ideology was still not really part of it. It was, okay, yes, there's a question of different values. We understand that. The idea of democracy embattled in Russia, the idea that the transition to democracy in Russia perhaps hadn't succeeded and was being reversed, but it wasn't an ideological conflict. But then one of the points I make in the book, so, and I'll quote it because I think it's worth doing now given the current environment, I point out that, just after he had stopped being vice president, Joe Biden said that the Russian government is brazenly assaulting the foundations of Western democracy around the world. It has sought to weaken and subvert Western democracies from the inside by weaponizing information, cyberspace, energy, and corruption. So that, to me, when I read the idea of brazenly assaulting the foundations of Western democracy, perhaps reintroduces an ideological aspect to this. And I think there is, it's very important to make that explicit so that people realize the trajectory that we're on. Because the ideological aspect will create a number of very concrete orthodoxies that will shape our own discussion of Russia, which may not be satisfactory.
Yeah, and there are no draws in an ideological battle. You either win or you lose, because you're dealing with truths, and people take, you know, so I'm already have to be cautious, because in the U.S., these truths are held very, very sharply. So this is the struggle. So I, what I would, you know,
encourage readers to refresh their knowledge of this struggle with Andrew Monaghan's dealing with the Russians. It's like a primer for the understanding, thinking person's understanding of the institutions, the language, the ideas, and the history, with a real focus on what's happened over the past, call it 5-6 years, as we go forward and try to, and again, here, come up with a policy. Unfortunately, there are many policies, whether you're, whether it's London, Brussels, Washington, D.C., or Moscow. So, but at least to keep track of how these debates are going, this is a very helpful tool and kind of uchebnik, if I may, for keeping up to date with the various, with this stage of our relationship with the Russians. Andrew, do you want to kind of end it with I hope a positive outlook, but if not, then at least a suggestive outlook that as to you know, that there is some light at the end of the tunnel, or if not, what it ought to be.
Well, thank you, first of all, Daniel, for inviting me to join you. It's been a pleasure to talk through these questions with you. What I really want to do with the book is to urge people to offer a fresh way of approaching this, because I think the interesting aspects of coping with the current challenge is to think in 21st century terms, and this does pose a whole new agenda in many ways. Whether it's about technology, whether it's about, as I mentioned earlier, demography and urbanization or the climate, these are very real issues that are right at the top of our public agenda. And you mentioned earlier, you know, the right question, probably the right point about the voters. But these issues are all across the news, and they keep coming back to them. I really hope that by stimulating some perhaps some fresh thinking for policymakers, it would also be of interest to the reading public to think about how we go about engaging with this challenge. There is no need for us to end up in some systemic ideological struggle to the death, but it's going to require a great deal of fresh thinking, and that hopefully is a spur to people when they read this. But I once again thank you for allowing me to join you and talk this through. It's been a pleasure to speak.
It has been for me as well. Again, the book is Dealing with the Russians by Andrew Monaghan. It just came out from Polity Press. Andrew, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.